Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 7th day of September. I know it feels like November, but it's the 7th day of September, Anno Domini 2024, and you, oh, you lucky people, you're listening to Sound Bites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And I am the Phantom.
And the Phantom has joined us. He will be helping us talk about our first story of the week. And we are going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news. Verizon said, I want to thank the approximately 15,000 people who sent me this news item. And I mean that sincerely. I do thank you. I'd rather have too many people send it than nobody send it. So thank you. Verizon said on Thursday it will buy fiber optic internet provider Frontier Communications in an all-cash deal worth $20 billion with a B dollars, as Verizon looks to grow its subscriber base. The deal will also help one of the biggest U.S. network providers better compete against rivals AT&T and T-Mobile as they double down on unlimited plans and bundling options. Verizon has offered $38.50 per share, representing a premium of 37.3% to the closing stock price of Frontier on September 3rd, a day before reports of a potential acquisition first emerged. Frontier has a total debt of $11.25 billion with a B dollars as of June 30th, which will be refinanced by Verizon as part of the deal. Frontier has 2.2 million fiber subscribers in 25 states, which will combine with Verizon's roughly 7.4 million to be more competitive in additional markets. Together, the company will have 25 million fiber passings, or the number of potential customer locations a fiber network passes by. AT&T has about 28 million such locations. The deal is expected to close in about 18 months and will help Verizon, whose fiber network is largely in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic regions, tap into Frontier's coverage in multiple states in the Midwest, Texas, and California. It would also be a reunion of sorts. Verizon had in 2016 sold its TV and internet business in California, Texas, and Florida to Frontier in a $10.5 billion with a B dollar deal, which included a portion of its fiber networks and customers. Analysts said the deal would provide only a modest boost to Verizon. Verizon's fiber network covers less than 10% of the U.S., and the acquisition will give it roughly another 3%, while AT&T covers less than 15%. So Verizon is, with the purchase of Frontier, Verizon catches up a little bit closer to AT&T. So our poll of the week, it's soundbites.org. That is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Verizon is buying Frontier to boost their fiber network. And your choices are fiber at last. Woohoo! Things will get better. Things will get worse. Things will be more expensive. Things won't change much. And what does this mean for my landline? So far, we have 22 votes. And things will get more expensive, shockingly, is in the lead. And you can vote in the poll at soundbites.org, Bites with a Y. And you can also join us by giving us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. So this is going to be a pretty big deal all the way around. And of course, it isn't finalized yet. The shareholders have to vote.
Ink is still wet.
The ink is still wet. The shareholders have to vote to finalize it. But Phantom, you had some thoughts about that.
Shareholders are going to make a pile of cash on this. I mean, if you think about it, and I was on staff in the 2015 California, Texas, Florida poll when they bought it. And that was, as you said, 10.5.
Yeah.
Now they're selling the whole shebang for 20.
Yeah.
I mean, shareholder is going to just rig it in. But again, what's going to happen afterwards with
right? The question rigs. Is what happens locally? What happens to our local fiber? You know, those of you who have Verizon fiber already, or Verizon anything already, certainly have more knowledge of what's going to go on. You know, I have a Verizon line. It's not, I don't have Verizon fiber. I have Greenlight, but I have a Verizon phone.
We had some customers in Palmyra that had Verizon internet, and it was okay because that's the only choice they had.
Well, exactly. We'll see what that means in the long term. What's interesting is the real question becomes two things. What happens with landlines? Because Verizon could not considerably care less about landlines.
A lot of companies have been petitioning to not have landlines at all.
Right. Yes. So the people who have landlines, what happens to them? Do they disappear?
Mm-hmm.
What happens? Secondly, and this has an impact on a lot of people, what happens to my Frontier email address?
Yeah. So,
one of the things we tell people regularly is don't have an address with an internet service provider.
So Frontier has said, because Frontier already stopped posting mail,
right.
Switched everyone to Yahoo, still using your Frontier address. And I just found out this week that Cox Cable out west did the same thing.
Right.
So Frontier had said that you get to keep your address forever. And Yahoo apparently is agreeing to that. So, but we don't know when that could stop at any time.
Right.
So you know, get a different email address, get a straight Yahoo address or Gmail or iCloud. It's not tied
They're all
to
free.
Your ISP. Yeah.
And now is the time to do it while you still have your old address.
Yeah.
Because you can then say to everyone you care about, here's the new address, change it in your address book, use this.
It's worse than physically moving, because you can do a change of address card. Telling everyone your new address and getting them to put it in their address book, because they won't. So you want to make sure your old address works for a while so you can keep track of. And that one magazine subscription that you forgot about.
Right.
Yep.
So it's important to do that.
And I think something else to remember also is Frontier is a large retiree base in Rochester.
Absolutely.
What's going to happen to their benefits?
That's a very good question. We have seen both ends of that spectrum where you were, you know, well taken care of with the new company and other places that told you to go take a hike.
Pound salt.
So we don't know where that's going to go for retirees, and I'm sure that's top of mind for each and every one of them. If your retirement account is with Frontier, that's a thing you're paying attention to significantly. Again, we have no information about that yet. So good luck, and we'll find out what happens.
Yeah. So and like Phantom said, if you already own Frontier stock, you're going to get a bigger dividend.
Yeah. So if your retirement account is Frontier stock, you win.
Yeah. Too bad us hold it.
Right. Yeah, right. But so we'll see. We'll see where that takes people, and we'll see how well Verizon does with it. You know, we've seen acquisitions that went brilliantly. We've seen acquisitions that got fumbled.
Warner.
What?
AOL Time Warner?
Yeah, exactly. AOL, exactly. That may have been the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see where that takes everybody, but it's going to be a long time before it all falls out. So you do have time, but again, we would suggest that if you have a Frontier email address, just to be on the safe side, change it. Get a Yahoo address. Get a Gmail
free
address.
Gmail. Yeah.
It's always good to have a second address anyway. Then you can use your old address as like a throwaway address. I want to sign up to read this comment, but I have to create an account. My throwaway address, so I don't care anymore.
Right. Exactly. So you can do that, and then tell people use your new account. Start sending from your new account. So when they reply to the new account. And then your old account is just there for grins and giggles.
Yeah. I'd be interested to see if they keep the Frontier brand, because Frontier's been around over 100 years here in Rochester.
Right.
In one form or another.
Right.
Well, if you remember, first Logo Frontier is bought by Global Crossing. Then it went to Citizens. And then now it's going over here. And just don't know how it's going to go.
Right.
The CTF purchase from Verizon was handled very poorly.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, and hopefully they've learned from that. But we'll see. All right. To the phones. Our first caller is Gary from Rochester, New York. What's up, Gary?
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes. You spent a lot of time with me last week with a problem, and I'll give it a quick, and we couldn't quite figure it out, and I'll just review it quickly, is that I do have Yahoo and still get my mail through a Frontier address, and I have an HP printer, and I was unable to print emails from my inbox to get them printed on the HP printer.
When they were attachments in Adobe.
Well, I'll tell you, I kept playing around with it, and I found out a way to use Adobe to get the attachments printed, and that I could solve myself. But as for taking emails that were direct text rather than attachments, I just couldn't do it. Well, I played around with it and did the usual things, and you helped me with it. And finally, I had a tech come in, and he couldn't find it at first. But what he traced it to was Firefox, and he looked up, because I do use that as a browser, and he looked up on their history and found over the years this problem did show up in many editions of Firefox in spite of updates through a number of years that people weren't able to print from directly from their inboxes directly to a printer. And he uninstalled Firefox, reinstalled it, then refreshed it, and it worked fine.
Interesting.
Isn't it?
Good. Yeah.
It really is. And if I had a second question, if you've got time, I don't know.
Sure.
Well,
okay.
For half a second, one of the problems with trying to print from a website is that if you use the file print command on the website, you're going to get the whole website with everything around it. And so what a lot of web mail interfaces do, and I'm looking at Yahoo Mail now, I finally got into my Yahoo Mail account.
Congratulations.
I haven't logged in years. In the message, there's a little printer icon.
That's right.
That will print just that message.
That, and he suggested that as well. He figured that out, rather than using the print signal in the print preview.
Right.
Rather than hitting that. But it is a pretty idiosyncratic problem with that browser.
Interesting. Good to know. Thank you.
Okay. And the question is, I know, Nick, you've talked in recent shows about using the DuckDuck browser. I use DuckDuck as a search engine, DuckDuckGo as a search engine, but it seems to me you did mention using it, the browser, for certain things. And am I right in that?
Yes, they do have a browser. And their browser theoretically is much more private and you know, et cetera, et cetera. The whole DuckDuckGo brand is about privacy. So you can use the DuckDuckGo browser, and it is available for Mac and Windows and iPhone and Android, but not for Linux. Grumble, grumble, grumble. And they have an extension for Chrome and Edge and Firefox and Opera and Safari. So you can either download the whole thing or put their extension in Firefox, which is not quite the same thing, but works pretty well.
Yeah. So the extension for the search gives you privacy on your searches, so it doesn't track what you're searching, but not the rest of the things on the browser page.
Right,
so the DuckDuckGo browser is better at hiding the rest of the things on the page. The problem we're running into now is that many websites start asking you to turn off all that blocking, because that's how they make their money. So they want you to turn it off to let you into that site. Sometimes you can just say, okay, I won't go to that site. I'll go to a different site. Right. Now, if you're looking at a news story, you'll find 100 places that have the same news story on it, many without a paywall. But sometimes you just have to whitelist a site to let turn the blocking off.
Right.
Okay. Well, while he was here, the tech did install the ad blocker that you've often suggested. I can't remember. Is it uBlock?
uBlock Origin.
Yeah, and he shut off the ad blocker in Firefox, and he shut up. There was another one that I had on, and they were superfluous, and he thought this would be better. So, and I think you've recommended it in the past, too.
uBlocker is the one I use personally, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you. And I was going to ask a question about Verizon, but of course you've answered it. And we'll just keep my eyes open and definitely get another email address. Because as a legacy, when Yahoo took completely over, Frontier let me use the Frontier email address. But it's going to be obsolete, probably. But we'll see. It's an interesting thing to follow.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's a crapshoot, right? You can gamble that they're going to keep it. You can gamble that they're going to get rid of it. Certainly having a second address is good no matter what else you do.
Yeah,
right.
It's such a well-known issue, Frontier moving to Yahoo, that the bad guys are putting out fake notices. Oh, you haven't moved to Yahoo yet. You better click here and do it.
And if something gets compromised, you always have this as a backup address, especially if you do a Google email address that you can then say, all right, well, send it to this address, as far as the Google one, if the other one has been compromised.
Also, if you get locked out of your account, you need a second address somewhere.
Yep.
To get back into your account. And
the other advantage of Google, though, is you gained 15 gig of free storage.
Yeah, I know that. Well, thank you. You've more than answered my question, and I'm sure other listeners are going to talk about Verizon as the months come up. But,
yeah. All right, thanks, Gary.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
So Yahoo gives you a terabyte of mail quota, but
Nice.
They don't have a disk version of it, like Google Drive and iCloud Drive. So email yourself files if you want to store them there.
Right, exactly. There are lots and lots of ways to store, to back up your data. Certainly storing it on Yahoo, you get a lot of space, but it's the least convenient way to do it. But you can do it. You know, 15 gig sounds like a lot, and it is if you're talking about office product things.
Text files.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Documents and spreadsheets and like that. The minute you start saving PowerPoint presentations with
movies,
lots of pictures in them, or music, or movies, or, video of any sort.
Yep.
15 gig is very tiny.
We would always have trouble convincing the IT staff at our customers. We worked with the graphic department, and they had like a global, 5 meg mail limit. Well, I send one graphic file, that's 100 megs. I want to send the entire magazine. Well, that's 100 gigs.
Right.
So give us more space, or set up an FTP. What's FTP? So you're an IT guy.
If you're the IT people and you don't know what FTP is, you need to leave.
Yeah.
You need to You need to go find a commune somewhere and weave baskets.
That's the old school FTP.
Right.
Yeah. I can tell somebody's old school if they still have an FTP address.
Right. Or Archie.
Archie and what was the other one?
Can't think of it.
There was Fetch. Gopher.
Gopher, was it.
Oh, that's an oldie.
That was it. I actually was reading an article about Gopher the other day. There's still Gopher servers in the world. Go for you puppies out there, you young little shave tails who don't know anything about anything. Back in the day, not only did we only have text on our screens, but we used the internet when we had it.
1991.
With things like Gopher and Archie and stuff like that. Those were the days. And many of us who are Linux users, there's all kinds of command line text only programs that you can use these days, which are faster and easier. One of the things is there are multiple text-only web browsers that are available for every operating system, actually. And one of the beauties of them is, again, they don't have any ability to be compromised with bad JavaScript or drive-by downloads or bad ads or anything else. So often, if I'm going someplace that I think might be a little sketchy, I'll do it in text because I can get all the data I want and get all the information I want without the problem or the possibility of downloading a problem, a virus of some sort.
Fortunately, gone are the days when the website was one giant flash.
Oh, yes! Flash. No. Do you know why Flash died?
Because Steve Jobs wouldn't put it on the iPhone.
No, because Google couldn't search it.
Ah.
And websites, if they wanted to be searchable, they needed to be on Google. Google couldn't search Flash.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And Google all by itself essentially just killed Flash. Yeah, it was, again, you puppies don't know this, used to be able to go to a website that had, you know, everything blinked, everything moved around. There were little thises and thats. It was cuter than heck. And
because you have flashing text doesn't mean you should use it.
Exactly right. I was experimenting the other day with some stuff, and I threw a blink in there just for the hell of it. And I looked at it for about 8 seconds and thought, we're done now. That was enough blink for the 2000s. We're done.
Yeah, but that was computers for 20 years, was a blinking cursor.
Yep, exactly right. There's all that stuff that's out there. And
there are a collection of people that still keep those old protocols alive. The Internet Archive is archiving a lot of the old games. And some of the Flash games, they've been able to some converter into something, you know, HTML5, so that you can play some of the Flash games.
Yeah, if you're into retro gaming, the Internet Archive at archive.org has an amazing amount of stuff.
And the emulators are fantastic.
They work really well. And you know, they're emulating an old game console over the internet.
That had a 5 megahertz CPU and 128 megs of RAM.
Right.
Okay, probably back then, too.
128K of RAM. Yep. Yeah.
The game is smoking crack.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
There were some early Apple II games. The first Apple II was, 4.77 megahertz?
Yeah.
And then when they came out with an 8 megahertz version, the games had been written assuming a 4 megahertz clock.
Right.
And then suddenly the game played twice as fast because it had an 8 megahertz clock. And so completely unplayable because just everything went so fast.
It went too fast. So remember the game with the floating eyeballs going through the maze?
Maze Wars. Maze Wars, yeah.
Maze Wars. We used to lug our Macs around and land them together.
You could fire a missile that would go through a teleporter and then kill someone from behind because you saw where the other end of the teleporter was.
Yep. Those were pretty hot games back in the day.
Yep.
At 4 megahertz, we were smoking, baby. I don't know what we were smoking, but we were smoking.
A little cheap.
And they were cheap. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, the Phantom, and me. I'm Nick Francesco. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Don't go too far.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35... Oh, sorry. Go.
I'm the Phantom.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites. I apologize to the Phantom for stepping on his intro there.
Didn't see him there.
He's a Phantom. He fades into the woodwork. Yeah. We have no idea he's here half the
like
time.
Like a fog comes in.
He's like the fog. He's like the shadow. He's fogged our minds.
Does he know what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
He does. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Bruce from Greece, New York. What's up, Bruce?
Yeah, hi. I love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
Yes, I have a TCL Roku TV. I can give you the model number if you want. But what I do is I use my phone, which I'll tell you about, and I use their hotspot to connect to my television to watch TV on Pluto. And I went to a factory reset on the television, and now they won't connect.
Can other devices connect to your hotspot? Like your computer?
I don't have any other devices to use it for. I only use it for my television, so I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, so you reset your television.
Correct.
And then you reconnected to your hotspot, and it doesn't work.
Correct. I changed the password on my phone, and I changed the password on the television, and it sees the TV sees the phone, but it won't communicate.
Is it giving you an error message when you try to connect?
Yes. I think it's 0009, but I'm not positive. I'm sorry, I didn't write it down. But
crazy.
Steve is looking up that error message now. It's always good to have the error message.
Yeah.
I know. I have everything else. I have the model number of my TV. I have everything. Swinimus.
Now, do you use I don't know if you've got like a laptop that you also use that as a hotspot or tether to your phone?
No laptop.
Yeah, you might want to try, getting a friend to try to use their laptop to connect to your hotspot.
Yeah.
So the problem is you don't know which end it's at. Is it the TV not joining the hotspot, or is it the hotspot not publishing itself properly?
Okay.
It's likely the television because that's the one you reset.
Yeah. Yeah. And did you say this was a Roku-based TCL?
Yeah. Okay. I got the model number. It's a TCL model 32S3750. A TCL Roku TV.
And with the TV, you had to put in your hotspot's password again?
Correct.
You sure you didn't type something a character that incorrectly?
No, I did it many times.
And the response you get on the screen is a 0009 error.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah,
I'll have to do it again to make sure, but I'm pretty sure.
I'm seeing a few things about this, just the generic internet connection error. But let me post this link to reset your communication settings on the television and on the phone. Are you using an Android phone or iPhone?
Android.
Okay.
It's a Samsung. It's through Straight Talk. Are you using an Android phone
or iPhone? Android. All right. Let's see. Where is my add latest link button? There it is. Add link. You know when you have too many links, you can't find the link you want?
Exactly right.
I'll put it at the top. Okay, yeah, now I have too many at the top.
Basically, the thing it says is to restart the TV again.
Yeah, I've done that many times.
Yeah.
So.
But yeah, check. So you get this big purple box that says can't connect to the internet. Yes.
No, I don't get that. I just get the error message. I just get this random error message.
Remember when you try to open an internet stream, you know, like Netflix, what does it tell you?
I don't have Netflix.
Well, whatever stream, even streamer service you use.
The only thing I do is Pluto, and it won't, it just won't let the password work. I changed the password on the phone, and then I changed the password on the Roku TV to match them, and it the TV sees the phone, it sees the hotspot, but it won't let the password work.
Could it be a Pluto password issue? That's why I'm wondering.
No. Pluto is free.
Yeah, Pluto is free.
There's no password on Pluto.
Okay, so what I'm... Okay. So you... It won't let the password work. What you mean is you type in the password, and it comes back and says no connection.
It just comes up with an error code.
0009.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay, so, that's important. If it's a 009 error code, it means it's connected to your phone, but it's not connected to the internet through the phone.
Okay.
So, it's not the connection from the Roku to the phone, it's the connection from the phone
to
the internet. If it was a error code 013, then it would be there's like 15 other codes.
Mm-hmm.
But 009 says it is indeed connected to your phone. It's just your phone is not connected to the internet. That's what that message says.
Try turning off your hotspot, restarting the phone, and turning the hotspot back on again.
I've done that too. I've been doing this for a couple of weeks now, and so who do I call? Straight Talk, or do I?
Well,
you need to know what kind of
you need to know where the problem is first. Trying another device on your hotspot, and if that works, then you know the problem is in the TV. If that doesn't work, the problem is in the phone.
Yeah, like if you
invite a friend, as Dave said, invite a friend over who's got a laptop.
Laptop, yeah,
and have them try to connect.
Nick?
What?
What are you doing later, Nick?
I need right. But invite somebody over who's got a laptop, and they can try to connect using your or a phone. They can try to connect via phone through your hotspot. And if they can't, then you know that's where the error is. And if they can, then you know the problem is in the TV. But you got to do that step before we can say definitively who you should call. It could be a problem that Straight Talk can figure out. It could be a problem that you have to talk to the Roku people to figure out. But, you know, until you know, because the first thing each one is going to say is, have you tried this?
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't tried it, they're going to say, hang up.
Yep, try it and get back to
they're
us.
They're going
to
blame.
Get back to us.
Blame the other guy first.
We have, the Phantom has had extensive experience with tech support, and he knows that is exactly what's going to happen.
Yes, if you don't do the basics,
right?
They're going to tell you to do the basics first,
right? So that's find somebody with some device that can connect through your phone to the internet.
Don't use special characters in your password, like exclamation point or dollar sign. Sometimes systems don't like that. Just use straight alphanumeric,
right?
Okay.
But definitely, you know, find somebody with a phone or a tablet or a laptop or something that could connect it through your hotspot to the internet.
Oh, you can go to their house and do it, too, because it's...
It's your phone. They don't have to come to you. You can go to them.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but that's your next step. It's got to be... That's, you know, we're going to troubleshoot it. You got to take each step individually. You skip a step, and it's not troubleshooting anymore.
Yep.
It's not a dance.
Yeah. Exactly right. Okay.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Yeah, I hate it when the answer is try something else and call us back later, but that's it.
And one of the things we run into a lot is you might forget what you've tried. Well, I tried that already, but then write down the list of things you tried. Try one thing at a time. If you make two changes, you don't know which one fixed it.
Right. Write down everything you did and write down what worked. You know, put a big arrow and a circle around the thing that actually worked. So if it happens again, you can go right to that thing.
Or if something changes, you get a different error message or it gets farther in the process to let you then open an app on the Roku.
I get the frustration.
It could even be a Pluto problem.
Right.
Delete and reinstall the app, but you can't without the internet.
Right. So, and I get the frustration. You want to watch your Pluto shows, and you can't, but you got to be, and this is the thing we see so often. Troubleshooting is methodical.
Yep.
It's step by step, one thing at a time. Start with the simplest thing, eliminate it, move to the next thing, eliminate it, et cetera, et cetera. And if you try to jump ahead, you're just going to screw everything up.
And you're going to just be more confused. And the thing of it is, though, is like we said, one of the easiest things is if you got another friend that's got a laptop, or that just
a tablet or another phone.
Yeah, bring it, go over to them and see if they can connect to your hotspot.
Or Kindle, any of those things, anything that connects to the internet,
yeah.
Have them connect through your hotspot.
And if that works, because from the error message that you were talking about, that's what it was saying, is it just couldn't get to the internet.
Right.
Voila.
So that's the only way you'll really know.
So the hotspot function could not be working, or I would imagine he would have unlimited data on his plan if he's doing television streaming. But
yeah,
right.
Sometimes unlimited doesn't mean unlimited.
I mean, it is very likely that the problem is in Roku because it's the only thing he changed.
Yeah,
but you cannot rule it out until you've ruled it out. So you gotta go do what you gotta go do. So all right. A tautology's everywhere. Thank you very much. All right. Last month, it was discovered that an inactive piece of software that shipped on all Google Pixel smartphones presented a potential security vulnerability for device owners. The company quickly said it would remove Showcase.apk, which was created years ago for Verizon, and Verizon is back, in-store demo devices and is no longer being used. But on the off chance that it were ever exploited, cybersecurity firm iVerify found that the software could make phones, and I quote, accessible to hackers and ripe for man-in-the-middle attacks, code injection, and spyware, end quote. The flare-up was enough for some companies to implement company-wide bans on Android devices. At the time, Google told us that it had seen no evidence of any active exploitation, and with this release of the monthly Pixel software update, it's getting rid of Showcase APK altogether. Other than that, it's a very small update with improvements to Wi-Fi stability and performance for Google's brand new Pixel 9 portfolios. The only other real bullet point. Bigger software upgrades await next month. That's when Google plans to roll out Android 15 to its devices. So is your Pixel device up to date? If it is, give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. You can wait for your phone to tell you it's time to update, or you can go into settings, which is the big blue and white gear, and then down to system, and one of the choices there is software updates, and you can then check your system update, which the last update was September 5th, 2 days ago. Yes, my system is up to date. Thank you very much.
So a lot of the times your devices will auto-install the updates. That's often a checkbox.
Right.
But because Apple and Google have literally billions of customers,
Right.
It might not get to your phone for a few days or a week because they don't want to send out a billion updates at once. And if there's a problem, you know, a CrowdStrike, they don't want it to brick anything. So your phone may not be in the latest version because it hasn't got it yet. But you proactively asking to check for update.
We'll do it.
We'll find it and bring it in.
Also on that page is app updates, where you can check for updates to any of your apps. For example, I have 11 updates pending, so I'm going to click update all and let them update while we're talking. And it's important to keep all of your apps up to date because particularly for security updates. You know, some updates are just we added this or we changed this color or we moved this button 2 pixels to the right. Okay, big deal. But a lot of updates are security updates, and you want them immediately. So checking once a week, you know, Saturday afternoon, you're sitting around with your feet up and an adult beverage and watching the game. Check for updates on your phone. Let them update while you're watching the game. Every Saturday, it's a good habit to get into. Takes 2 minutes of your time. And is the thing you wanted to be doing.
I was at a customer this week setting up a new router for them, and we couldn't install the router app on his phone. It just said pending, pending, pending. All right, well, let me try another app. Pending, pending, pending. All right, check for Google updates. Google update, installed. Oh, pending went to installed.
Yep. So I had that with my wife's phone yesterday.
Well, why didn't it update automatically? Well, it hadn't got to it yet.
Right, it would get to you, but you can proactively do an update by yourself, and we recommend that. Look, the fact is, you're a systems administrator now.
Whether you want to be or not,
get over it.
You know, and it's systems plural. You've got systems, a phone,
right.
Computer, your spouse, your children.
Right, you everybody's systems. Got devices. Somebody has to manage them. That's you. If you're listening to this show, you're the geek in your house, and you're the one who has to update everything. And I get it. Nobody wants to relinquish their device for 4 minutes. Nobody wants you playing around with their stuff. But if you don't keep it updated, you're going to run into problems.
Especially if you have an elderly relative who simply doesn't know how to do it on their own, like my 96-year-old father. No, I'm going to take care of it for you. Don't worry about it.
Right. Every person, it seems like every person on the planet has a computer of some sort, whether it's phone-shaped or tablet-shaped or computer-shaped. You've got a computer, and somebody's got to be managing that computer. Somebody's got to be the systems admin. And if it's not them, it's you, particularly in your own household. So be aware of that and be careful and keep things updated. That's your and it's, you know, it's everything. Check your printer for an update. They come through. Check your router. Check your computer. You've got a Raspberry Pi sitting in the corner just chuckling away to itself. Make sure it's properly updated all the time. You know, set a day every week to check every device. And I do mean every device. Do you have Ring doorbells? Check them.
Home security cameras?
Home security cameras. Check them.
Smart thermostat?
Check them.
Setting up the new router. We got the new router updated. One of the tricks is make the wireless name and password the same as the old router.
Oh, yes.
So then all your devices reconnect?
Yes.
23 devices on the network with 2 people living in the house.
Yep.
So it's going down smart speakers, smart thermostat, smart picture frames.
Right. And your smart speakers, check them for updates. It's just there's a 100 devices in your home. If you have a smartwatch, check it for updates. They're important, and you should be doing it regularly. I know. It's a pain in the patoot. I get it. And most of the time, when you do that, you sit there on that Saturday afternoon, and most of them say, no update, no update, no update. Good for you. sometime they will say update, and it's important that you get that update.
And then the next zero-day vulnerability that's found and being exploited won't affect you because you've already run the update.
That's right. You know, people say, people often say, how can I protect myself against viruses and malware and all that other stuff? The number one item is keep everything up to date. Keep everything up to date. Now, I grant you, with Microsoft, there's a whole month of so what. You know, you're not going to get the updates except on Patch Tuesday. With Linux, you get them hourly. With Mac, you get them quite regularly. With Android, you get them quite regularly. But you know, you got to do it. You got to check once a week at the very least.
And many attacks come through web pages.
Right.
We used to be able to say, you know, stay off the seedy areas of the web.
Right.
But now, attacks come from ads on web pages. Every web page has ads. There was a classic example a few years ago with Forbes started demanding you turn off your ad blocker in order to read Forbes. All right, so I turned off my ad blocker. Instantly, my antivirus program popped up and said, hey, there's a virus attacking you.
Yeah, exactly.
It came from an ad going into the website. So yep. Legitimate, normal, safe web pages with the automated ads that are happening can get attacked by malicious software. And if you don't keep your browser and AV and anti-malware up to date, you don't have to click on anything. Just displaying that ad in your browser will cause the malicious software to attack.
And browsers have gotten so powerful, they can't install software on their own.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people run ad blockers, and so then the websites put in ad blocker blockers.
Right.
So the ad blocker puts in a blocker to the ad blocker blocker.
Game of leapfrog.
And the game of leapfrog goes on.
Yep.
Yes, and you know, we talk about all the ways to protect yourself. That is the simplest, because you generally don't have to do anything but click the update button.
Yeah. Backing up even a step, sometimes even simpler, is don't be an administrator. Every time you set up a new computer, it sets you up as the administrator. Well, administrator can install software and do critical things. Make a second account, a standard account, or normal account, depending on what your OS calls it, and do everything in there. Because you rarely need to install new software.
Right.
But if you do, you can go back to your admin account. And almost all, one statistic, it was like 90% of all malware that comes through web pages and internet messaging and email, things like that, are blocked because you're not the admin. They cannot auto-install.
Right.
So they might be in a message, but it can't do anything once it gets there because you're not the admin.
Right. And many operating systems now will let you install software by saying, are you sure you want to do this? Type in your password.
The admin password, separately.
The admin separate password.
Don't make it the same password.
Right. And so you can do that. Linux does that. Mac OS does that. And Windows is starting to do that. So you can now, you know, it's that extra step that should make you sit back. If you're browsing a web page and it pops up and says, are you sure you want to install that? Type in your password.
Yep.
Maybe you don't want to do that.
Well, the other thing we're starting to see now, a new method of attack. You go to like a news website and it might pop up and say, do you want to get notified of the latest news? Well, sure. I'd like that. Unfortunately, there's a malicious ad on that website and it's asking to be allowed to give you malicious ads. And then suddenly you get hundreds of ads saying that you're infected with a virus.
Right.
Because
or you've signed up for a monthly fee of $75.
It's almost impossible to tell the difference between what program is asking that permission.
Right.
So just say no.
Just say no. All right. That music tells us that the first hour of this show is done. But do not despair. Do not think we're finished. We have a whole nother hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. And not only is it the longest-running computer show in the known universe, we're hurtling headlong into our 35th year on the air. 35th year on the air. One of us is old, and I think it's Dave. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, the Phantom, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the creakingly oldest, longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites. Take a little bio break for yourself. Grab a beverage of your choosing, but don't go too far. We'll see you on the other side.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District, Jazz 90.1.
Celebrating 50 years on the air in Rochester.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
The Phantom.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites.
No, I might be old.
You are.
But for anybody out there, come Tuesday, somebody's going to be a little bit older.
That's true. The four of us have birthdays this month.
Yeah.
The three of us and Soundbites all have birthdays in September. I don't know when the Phantom's birthday is.
May 10th.
May.
Your birthday is Tuesday, so anybody out there and on Facebook, don't forget to wish Mr. Nick a happy birthday.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Every day is a triumph, and I'm delighted. Absolutely delighted.
It's always a good day when you can look down at the flowers and not up.
Yeah, other people tell me, I don't tell people my age. Are you kidding? I should have died at least three times in my life, and I'm still here. I will be 74 years old, and proud of it.
See, that's when you know you're old, is when you don't remember how old.
You don't remember how old. It's 70, and it's like, I don't
know. Well, it was the best thing for me. Matter of fact, it just happened last week. This one guy comes in and he had to buy some stuff. And he says, yeah, because I got to get over and get the bagels. It's my birthday, so I'm taking them on in. And I says, oh, how old are you? He goes, I turned 67. I go,
yeah. Yeah.
He goes, so I suppose you're going to tell me you're older? I said, how old do you think I am? Probably in your 60s. I said, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'll be 76 this year.
Yeah.
He goes, damn, you don't look it.
Yeah. Yep.
I'll hold at 55, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm 35, me and Jack Benny.
We used to joke with my boss that when her youngest turned 30, she couldn't be 29 anymore.
There was that. all right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Steve from Walworth, New York. What's up, Steve?
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. My question pertains to the number of devices on my network. I have a lot of devices.
Yep.
And recently I reached a point where my router, it's a pretty good router, wouldn't assign any more IP addresses. So what I did was I added a second router, gave it a different base IP address, and set up the HP for that. But now I'm running into the fact that, the good router that I bought said it was good for 255 devices, but it gets up to about 90, and it gives up in assigning IP addresses. So rather than going to a third router on the network, is there anything else I could do?
Well, the first router should give you up to 250 addresses.
Yeah, and you just got to open it up sometimes.
The trick is, where does it start? So if it starts at 100, you just lost the first 100. So when you're doing your DHCP table, start it at like 10, and then you should have 240.
Yeah, I have it starting at 50 right now. Anything less than 50 is static. And anything above that, it goes to 254, I believe. It doesn't go to 255.
Well, 0 to 254 is the range.
Right. Well, actually, 0 and 255 are both reserved for various things. So you really have 1 to 254.
And what I have seen occasionally on routers is if the IP address... the space runs out, that's because some device didn't release it in time. So normally, you might know this, the DHCP is for 24 hours, And at the end of that 24-hour lease, it says, hey, can I have the same address again? And the router almost always says, yeah, sure, here. Sometimes it gets a new address, and that first address is never released. If you restart your router, then everything starts over again at, you know, at your 50, 51, 52, 53, and then counts up again. So if you literally have 250 devices on your network, that's when you start needing multiple routers.
Right. If you have more than 200, generally speaking, 100 devices is really the limit you want on any one network, because otherwise you start getting a lot of collisions, mm-hmm. and it slows the network down considerably. But if you have fewer than 100 devices and you're still running out of addresses, then it's likely what Steve said, the lease time is too long.
Or it's not giving up the, it's not releasing okay. the lease when it needs to.
Right. So
I can change the lease time, but I start at 50, 192, 168, 150, and go all the way to 254. And it happens when it gets up to about 90 devices, and then it just stops.
How many devices do you have for your network?
On one network, there's about 90, and on the other one, there's about 45.
Okay, so you're looking at about 135 devices. That's
right.
That's okay. You could do that on one network, but again, you've got to manage your space, right? So if you've got 135 devices and you start at 100, you can only put you're going to crowd that device,
yeah.
that device space,
and cause collisions.
IP space, really hard. So you start at 50, you start at 20. You start at 10.
Yeah, I have both of them starting at 50 for the dynamic, and less than 50 is I have those reserved for static.
Okay, so from devices. 50 to 255, you should have, that's what, yeah. 200. So you should have enough space, but you're saying it dies at 90.
Is this a consumer brand router?
Right.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's supposed to be a very good one. It's an ASUS RX 6000, you know, is like $350.
That's a very good router, but it is not designed for commercial network. And that's okay. part of your problem.
Mm-hmm.
You need a commercial router. One that will really do, no kidding, 255 addresses.
Or you set up multiple LANs, 192.168.1.x and 192.168.2.x.
Right.
Then you have 250
yeah.
on each.
Right. So you can
okay.
so depending on what if your network starts at 192.168, then you have the other two numbers to play with.
Yeah, because one network is 1.1 and the other one is 0.1.
Yes, and that is exactly what
router.
You want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you
yeah.
can, and then you can bridge the two of them together so they can talk to each other. But what it sounds like is you've got a home-based router that is really not designed for more than 90
yeah.
connections, and it's doing the limiting for you because there's nothing in the internet protocol that would stop it from being
yeah.
But swamped.
This is the gaming router? The
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So gaming routers are well, they're rigged for gaming. So,
yeah.
So the latency of each packet is low, but not necessarily for the number of devices you have.
Yeah, usually they're
oh, okay.
set for maybe, you know, 2-3, you know, say at on an average household, you know, 2-3 folks, you know, maybe doing the same game, but not, you know, 140.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. We don't do any, it's just me and my wife, and we don't do any gaming, but I bought it for the low latency and the fact that it was advertised for 254 devices.
Right. Mm-hmm. The low latency really means internal to the network. Not out to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There's no
so
device
the
on the planet
heard,
that can guarantee the latency of the internet.
Yeah. One of the things I heard is I can lower my reservation time. Try that.
But that's what we're talking about. That's
yeah.
the when
yep.
you that's the lease time.
Lease
so,
time, rather.
Yeah,
yep.
yeah, yeah,
okay.
yeah. So instead of 24 hours, make it 4 hours.
Okay.
I mean, if you honestly have 190 devices on the network, particularly if they're not on all this at the same time. You can,
yeah, they pretty much are.
Then it doesn't
David
matter what the lease time
radio.
Is.
Yeah. It's 24 hours right now.
The house must glow.
Yeah.
No, it's all Dave. Dave, it's ham radio stuff with a lot of Raspberry Pis and light bulbs and switches and, you know, things like that and cameras. And
I should talk. I've got five Raspberry Pis going.
You should put all of your smart devices, your lamps and your switches and your this's and that's's, on one network, and all your home devices, like your TVs and your phones.
Computers and stuff.
All that stuff. On a separate network. The other reason for that is that many, many smart devices are not secure. And so if they are on a separate network, the likelihood that they will be an infection vector for your home devices is minimized.
Okay, I'm trying to do that. It's slow going. It'll take a while, but eventually that's my plan, is to have all the internet stuff on the second router.
Well, right. The one thing I can tell you, Steve, from just my personal experience, I mean, I'm still running off my router as far as the business. You know, I had a business once because we had all the computers down there.
And that's the key word when you're looking at a router. The gaming routers are fast for gaming. You probably want a business router to handle that many connections.
Yeah, so we had that, and then, you know, I added, of course, my ham stuff, along with, like I say, mm-hmm. I've got five Raspberry Pis going. And, it handles it okay. But, again, like mm-hmm. Steve was saying, it's a business one because, I needed it for the business at the time.
I mean, right. I'm looking at Cisco's low-end routers, and 50 is their sort of average.
So, if you have two separate routers, one on a 1.0 and the other on a 0.0, and put all of your Internet of Things devices on one and your personal devices on the other, you should also find that it speeds up everything because there's less latency, because there's fewer collisions between packets on the network.
Okay. All right. Yep. Do you have any recommendations for a business class router? It sounds expensive, much more expensive than
expensive, but if you've got two separate routers, then you don't need to add anything new to the network. You just need to reconfigure the network.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you've got fewer, so let's say each one can handle 90 devices. As long as you've got fewer than 180 devices, which I'm hoping you do, if you have fewer than 180 devices, you should be able to split them between the two networks and not have any trouble.
Tech Radar, I might post this article. So ASUS has a business class router, and I'm looking to see what the
I forget
price is.
What I paid for mine a while ago.
That was a while ago too. Keeps pointing me to the gaming class routers. And then, of course, Cisco is probably the king daddy of routers.
Right. But, as long as you have two routers, and as long as you split everything up evenly, fairly evenly, right?
Yeah, like...
You should be fine.
You know, put your ham stuff and all that on the smaller one, because you're not always going to have that equipment going along with the Raspberry Pis.
Right.
And, you know, as that be on your second network, because, you know, if they're not always being fired up, as opposed to, say, your personal one for the home, where you've got your TV and your tablets and maybe laptops and that connected and other devices within the house, you know, they be able to handle that part of it.
Well, again, I would do it a little differently. So this is why network management is an art, not a science.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I would put my home devices, like my tablets and my laptops and my televisions, on one network, and I would put all my Internet of Things, your Ring doorbells and all that, yada yada, on another network, and I would put the ham stuff on the same network as my computers.
Or a third network.
Or a third network, but on the same network as the computers, because A, they're not going to be running all the time.
Right. Well, that's right.
And B, you want to separate the Internet of Things stuff, mm-hmm. because that's where your viruses can get in more mm-hmm. easily.
And many routers call that a VLAN or virtual LAN.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just had one more related question, if there's time. You mentioned connecting the two. How would I do that? Because, like, I have one computer and I want to VNC into another computer, but it's on the other router. Is there an easy way to do that without opening up ports on both routers to talk to each other?
The routers should... Well,
is one router plugged into the other router, or the routers plugged into your internet separately?
No, it's one router is plugged into the other router.
Then you should just be able to use the plain IP address, and the router says, oh, this is not for me, I'll pass it upstream.
Theoretically, that will work. If not, you have to set up a bridge, and that depends entirely on which routers you have as to how you do that and if they can do that. And I'm not familiar with your router, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, I'll look in the manual on that, because some of the devices I can see, but others I can't see on, you know, each network. So
that's weird. It should be all or nothing.
Well, if the others aren't broadcasting their address, they're hiding it. So, for example, if I put a Raspberry Pi on a network, one of the things I can say to it is, don't broadcast that you're here.
Right, but if I type its IP address, I'll get into it.
If you type in your IP address, you'll get to it.
Yeah.
As to whether or not it will let you in is a whole other story.
Yeah.
And whether or not it will acknowledge that you're there.
Open, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it may be that on each of those devices, you have to tell it, open up these ports and open up acknowledgement to this device.
Okay.
But you know what? He just said the one dirty word, though. He was going to read the manual.
I know. What the hell is wrong with you?
He claims he's listening to the show. We don't read no stinking manual.
But the secret is the difference between the people who use computers and who are gurus is the gurus read the manuals. We don't want to tell people.
Let's let their trade secret out.
Sorry. All right, Steve, but you've got places to go and things to try now, so let us know how it works out.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen.
Have a good weekend.
Take care.
Yep, bye-bye.
And I thought my 25 devices was a lot.
We're pikers. We're pikers. Guys got
the house has to glow like all get out.
It's got to be. There's got to be
145 devices.
Well, no monitors. They're all just little computers.
And how's the power bill?
Yeah.
Well, exactly right. I wouldn't want his power bill, but you're right. He's got a bunch of cameras. And a bunch of, you ham people are nuts.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. You add things left and right, whether you need them or not. You know, unlike we computer people who only have multiple laptops, desktops.
You mean my four monitors and three radios?
We do top and bottom, not left and right.
Yeah. I can understand if he's got, you know, a dozen or more Raspberry Pis, and they're each doing this and that, and I get it. I absolutely get it, but... You can easily accumulate that number of devices, particularly if he's got handheld radios and all that other stuff that also connects to the... I get it.
They're considered like a walkie-talkie.
I get it.
What we call a handheld.
Yeah, I get it.
And those are probably being tied to the Raspberry Pis for your different types of...
And that happens over the internet. I get it. I get it. I absolutely get it. He could have that many devices.
Yep.
But using a home router to do that, he runs into the problem he's got, which is, in this particular case, the router just says, I'm done.
Time out.
Done. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's what I found on the Cisco. Their low-end Meraki series routers are rated for up to 50.
Right.
You go to the 900 series router, and then it can do 500, so it must have two VLANs on it.
Yeah, right. But the reality is that, you know, one of the things you say, why is it so expensive to put a network in my office?
Mm-hmm.
Because you need the higher end devices to do the higher end stuff
and avoid collisions. You know, everybody's pumping data. You figure an office, say 50, 60 people, and they're pumping data and spreadsheets and everything else back and forth to the servers and every place else, and out to the internet, and trying to avoid collisions and corruptions is definitely a daunting task.
When you collide, when you send out a packet, it needs to go to the other end. If it collides with another packet in the network, then both of those devices have to resend that packet.
Yep. And the more devices you have, the more packets there are flying around.
The more packets there are flying around. So if every other packet you have is colliding with something, then your data stream just, the speed is got cut in half.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more devices you add, the slower your network, because it's not really slower. It's still running at, you know, a gigabit.
Yeah.
But because it has to resend half the data, it's now running at 500 megabits effectively.
Yeah.
And you double that again, now it's running at 256 meg effectively. So, you know, you want to stay under 100 devices on any one network, because as soon as you hit 100 devices, that's when collisions really start mattering. They'll happen with only two devices on the network, but they're minimal and they're, mm-hmm. who cares?
Yeah.
But when you they're start noise. Getting more than 90, more than 100 devices on a network, then you start having so many collisions that you start slowing down the network considerably.
Mm-hmm.
So many routers, many home routers, tap out at 90. That means you're going to still get the speed that you expect without a problem on those 90 devices. And let's face it, the normal, average, sane human being doesn't have 90 devices on their network. At least that used to be the case. It no longer is.
Yeah, with TVs now.
And if you've got four kids, do the math.
Yep.
So, and what with everything else that's out there, ham radio and, you know, my
doorbells
and my lawnmower and my pool will tell me when it's too cold. And
well, the Raspberry Pis that you can sit there and have it control your house and all the devices within it, that's talking to multiple devices, you know, whether it's the doorbells or the surveillance cameras and everything else.
Right. So you can easily swamp that 90 device router
piece of cake
without any trouble.
Although I will tell you, I've seen the ultimate use for Bluetooth in terms of Wi-Fi. My new toothbrush has Wi-Fi.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, mm-hmm. And so you can get a toothbrush with Wi-Fi.
Yeah,
I'm sure you can get a comb with Wi-Fi.
It'll tell you how good you brushed, but more importantly, it'll tell the mothership when you need to buy new brushes.
Right, and we'll also tell you how well you brushed.
Yeah.
So you can buy those for your kids and see how well they did brushing their teeth.
Well, yeah. Even better, they got beds. The control will track how you slept.
You start snoring it was it moves
yeah,
you.
Yeah. And adjust if you're a snorer and all that type of stuff. That's
I want to know about how like big football stadiums, you know, the big game, you have 100,000 people in one place. They're all going to want to be on the internet looking at things. How in the heck do you support internet at a football stadium?
Verizon talked about that.
Yeah.
They talked about wiring up one of the stadiums. Mm-hmm. I don't know. One of the football stadiums, and they said they were putting routers at every section.
Yeah, how many routers would they have? And
so, and it was,
what's
you know,
the pipe going in?
Again, 100 people to a section.
The pipe going into that sucker, though.
Well, exactly. And what it took to do that. And the
drive
number,
a semi through it.
Right. And the number of routers they needed and then the amount of the backbone that they needed and all of that.
Then you see all the trucks outside? Then you got all the internet trucks, and then you look next door, and you've got all the television trucks from every network. They're going to want their own bandwidth.
Well, and that's another question for Steve, is how big is his pipe to the internet?
Yeah.
Is he on fiber, so he's getting a gigabit for all of those devices? Many of them are just internal, so okay, I get that, but a lot of them are going out to the internet, and how fast is his internet connection?
Well, apparently, at the most recent Super Bowl, they used a record 34.8 terabytes of data.
Yes. Yeah, think about that.
Increase from last year's 31.5 terabytes.
Right.
And they have
used that on a weekend, but yes.
Yeah, they have a graph that's almost a straight line. From 2012, they used 300 gigs.
Yeah.
And now in 2024.
Well, because people don't just watch the game now. They watch the game and they watch the highlights.
You get the instant replay that you can't see.
The instant replay. Yeah. What are the odds on this happening and that happening?
You got to live tweet everything.
They're live tweeting everything. They're Instagramming. You know, God forbid you're not recording everything you do in your life every minute.
So it does say there were 62,000 people at the stadium, the smallest Super Bowl. since the pandemic. So
yeah.
So 62,000 people use 300 terabytes of data.
I'll let you do the math on that. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, the Phantom, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You are listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm the Phantom.
And at 33 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. I keep waiting for a promo to happen.
Yeah.
And they don't happen anymore.
Yeah. We're the promo.
Right. And as I mentioned earlier today, here at Soundbites, we are hurtling headlong into our 35th year.
We've been doing this?
Over 34 years. 34 years and 4 days, as a matter of fact. The 3rd is our anniversary, September 3rd, and that was our 34th anniversary. Unbelievable that we've been doing it this long.
Lasted longer than my first marriage.
Yeah. You came in pretty early. You came in fairly early.
Yeah. I was like maybe the third or fourth week. Yeah.
Yeah, the first week it was just me and the great and late lamented Bob Smith opening up a microphone and wondering what was going to happen with this show, where it was going to go and what it was going to do. And we've been rolling along for 34 years.
Mm-hmm.
Rolling.
And three different stations.
And it's up to, and that's on you people. All of you listeners, this is your fault.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be doing this. We'd be home relaxing,
mm-hmm.
enjoying ourselves. So it's your fault.
We fill a need
and it's better than filling a tooth. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 800-790-0415. Let me see, I've got, yeah.
But that's where, you know, come pledge time, you know, you start saying 35 years now. Yes, that's 35 years that we've been giving up our Saturdays.
Or Sundays. We started on Sundays.
Yeah, originally on Sundays. But we have been giving up our weekends to come in and do this show. And you folks have the option where we don't. We're here every week. Whereas you folks, if you feel like listening to the sound bites, you can. If you don't, you want to take a week off or a couple weeks off, you can. We're still here every Saturday from 12 to noon, bringing you the computer information that you need to solve your issues. So when it does come pledge time, just remember us.
Exactly right. All right. Google Workspace administrators, and remember, we're all administrators now, consider yourselves on notice. In less than a month, many third-party apps, mail, calendar, etc., will stop connecting to Workspace accounts. The change, effective September 30th, will see Google disable access to less secure apps, or LSAs, for all of Google's work accounts. Those who haven't checked their Workspace admin consoles recently will note that LSA settings have already been removed, so there's no avoiding this change. LSAs, as far as Google is concerned, is anything that doesn't use OAuth by way of sign in with Google. In other words, no more signing into Google Workspace with just a password, so get ready to apologize to some executives. This isn't a surprise announcement. Google's Workspace team published a blog post last year to announce the transition away from LSAs. Sign in with Google isn't exactly a new product either, so consider the next few weeks an opportunity to prevent a sudden surge in support tickets at the end of the month. Thunderbird, iOS, Mac, OS, Mail, iOS or Mac OS Mail, Thunderbird, Outlook for Mac, all of these users can simply re-add their Google accounts using the Google account option in setup. And the same goes for users of modern Outlook products. Anyone still sticking to Outlook 2016 will be out of luck, though, so this is your chance to finally force an upgrade. The same goes for calendar and contact applications that connect to Google Workspace accounts, so be prepared to use those to get those updated as well. Personal Google accounts won't be affected by the change yet.
They already did.
But you're right. You're much safer using OAuth on those as well. Mobile device management platforms that configure IMAP, CalDAV, CardDAV, POP, Exchange Active Sync, Google Sync are being phased out as well. Support for most of those products have already been phased out in June, and Active Sync will be disabled at the end of September. Admins will need to push a Google account in, using their MDM provider, which will re-add their Google account to iOS devices using OAuth. That was an amazing amount of geek talk in one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, the tech giant said that Google Workspace account connected scanners and other devices that use email to send documents will need to be, and that includes printers, will need to be reconfigured to use OAuth or some alternate method as well, because they won't connect after the end of September either. So are you OAuthed? Give us a call. Our phones just work. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415.
Google Steve is right. Has done this on personal@gmail.com accounts
right.
A while ago. And the other thing they do is if you have another Google app, like the YouTube app or the Google app, Google search app on your phone. So I just ran into this week with a customer. They're setting up their new computer. We log into their Google account. I've got the username. She knows her password. It says, on your iPad, tap 26.
Right.
The iPad they left at home.
Right.
So I say, oh, I'll try another way. No, we won't let you try another way because this is more secure.
You're exactly right. So you have multiple devices that do multiple things. Carry them around with you when you're doing upgrades and new systems.
And the one that says on your iPhone, named iPhone, that's tough.
Yeah.
If it's an Android phone, it usually tells you the model name.
Right.
But almost everyone's iPhone is named iPhone.
Well, you can go in and change the name of your iPhone, and you probably should.
Settings, general, about.
Right. Because generally speaking, those systems are going to be referenced at some point, yeah. Like Steve just said, in this instance. And in many others, so knowing the name of your phone, so, you know, Nix Pixel 7 as opposed to Pixel.
Yeah. I've had mine named Steve's iPhone for a while, but now I've started putting the model name on it because there's too many previous Steve's iPhones.
Well, exactly.
It was that we were at a Fairport concert at the Shell, and someone kept trying to airdrop me photos. And I kept trying. You know, I kept saying decline. Finally, I had to holler out wrong Steve, and I had to turn off all my radios. So.
Right.
So I'm sure they knew someone named Steve and trying to send a photo to them.
Because look, there's Steve's iPhone.
Yeah, I'll just use that one.
We had that problem at RIT. These people put up a brand new printer on the network, and on the Apple network,
mm-hmm.
and they named it with an A. The name started with an A. And I said, that's a very bad idea, because every Apple person who doesn't know what they're doing is just going to pick the first. They're going to see a list of 2,000 printers, and they're just going to pick the first one. So you're going to get everybody's printout.
Well, no one would be that stupid.
No one would be that stupid. And this was a giant color, beautiful,
yep.
Dollar a page, et cetera, et cetera. We set it up. Printed fine to the network. I told them once again, you really need to change the name. No, we want all our people to be able to get to it right away with that A. Okay. We went home. The next morning, I get a call. But we've been hacked. I come in. They printed 500 sheets, because that's all the printer held,
mm-hmm.
of porn pictures.
Yeah.
Woohoo.
Yep.
Okay, somebody somewhere at RID found this printer, thought, great, color porn pictures.
Yeah.
I'll print them out. And then couldn't find them anywhere and couldn't get them. So that was, you know, hundreds of dollars, an entire thing of ink.
Yep.
Of every color, mostly flesh-toned. And so we replaced all the ink and we changed the name of the printer to something that started with a Z.
Black and white, you know, piece of junk.
Right, yeah. Right.
No one to print to it.
Right. When I was at RIT, I named my printer Wastebasket.
Mm-hmm.
Who the hell's going to print to the Wastebasket?
Yeah. I used to work for a large photographic company here in town.
Wow.
And they had offices all over the world, and we always got a kick out of looking at the printer list. At least they had it broken down by continent.
Yeah.
But I could print to the printer in Taiwan.
Sure.
From here in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to a presentation next week. All right, I'll print 100 copies to your printer.
Right.
Then it's your budget, not mine.
Exactly right. I did that at work one time. It was a mistake, and I admit it was a mistake. I got a call from the guy, my boss, who said, I got these people in my office from corporate, and we need these data set up in this way, and blah, blah, blah. So it's a pivot table. I can do that in Excel. I've got all the data, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. He said, how long is this going to take you to do? I said, you hear your printer? There were mm-hmm. his data. That was it. I had his stuff all done. It was a mistake because then he never planned ahead of time. Yeah. He would always call me up and say, I need this for a meeting in 5 minutes. Screw you. Give me time. But that was my fault, and I admit fully that it was my error.
Yeah, from
error.
Then on there,
you didn't tell him. You didn't tell him how long it would actually take, did you?
Maybe tomorrow.
Yeah, right. So that was my fault. I admit it. But you can, when you set your systems up, be cognizant not only of what's easy for you, but of what's easy for everybody else too. And maybe make it a little less easy for you, so it's a little less easy for them.
I always feel so bad when I read stories about someone who walks up to the shredder and puts their papers in, and they don't quite know what button to push, so someone helps them, get it shredded, and then the guy says, okay, how do I tell it to make 100 copies?
You're right. Yep. Yeah. Well, and speaking of budgets, we had a faculty member who will remain unnamed. No, we won't remain unnamed. And he used to print his papers out on the color printer, text papers, on the color printer because he wanted a blue border around them. At $1 a page back then,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to 10 cents a page.
Why the blue border?
Because that's what he wanted. Shut up.
It was pretty.
So that
they
stopped
say higher education.
Yeah, that stopped the day that I told him this now comes out of your budget, not our budget. Immediately, how do I go to the other printer? Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When I did work at this large photographic company, they had two giant high-end 100 copies a minute copiers. They wanted you to use for personal projects.
Because they want to test them.
Run up to, this one had 1 million pages on it. That had 5 million pages. So I used to do the Cider newsletter.
Sure.
So it was 200 copies of 20 pages.
And it was
front
completely
and
legitimate.
Yep. At auto-stabled, auto-collated,
best.
Auto-folded. I hit the button, come back in 5 minutes, and I have my 200 copies.
Yep.
And
yep.
I might feed you breakfast, too.
Yeah. Yep. But I've talked to people at some of the large copier makers, and the 100 pages a minute is about as fast as they can go. They can't move the paper any faster through the mechanism. They're already using a partial vacuum
right.
to cut down on wind resistance.
And the reason they can't move it faster is because of air.
Yeah, the air resistance holding the
air resistance, you can't go more than 100 pages a minute.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to have that problem with checks at Chase.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't print them fast enough. We just had to keep adding check printers.
Yep.
Because you couldn't do it any faster.
Oh, the giant computers. We went to see Thomas Crown Affair, the original 1968 version of Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where he goes into the check writing room and these monster computers. And there's a screen terminal there, and he types a couple of things, and then you hear the clackety clack of a teletype, and a check comes out. It was so funny.
And you see the reel-to-reel tapes.
Yeah, yeah.
She's going back and forth. I love that stuff. Love that stuff. Yeah, we had. I worked at a company where we had two giant Docutechs, which printed manuals, giant manuals. Mm-hmm. 200, 300 page manuals. And they were mostly spiral bound. But watching those things actually print something, we need 50 copies of this manual. Vroom. This thing sounded like a jet engine. It would
ripped through them, though.
Ripped through them. You know, most of the, we had people whose entire day was just reloading the trays.
Yeah, we used
that's all they did.
We had a customer that was a sign company, and they used to make 10-foot by 4-foot signs, and it took all day to make one sign.
Yep.
And they would get an order for 300 signs for a trade show, so they had a year lead time. We sold them a 54-inch solid ink printer that could print. So they went down. They went down from 4 feet to 3 feet, I think it was. It could print one page, one entire sign in like 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And you filled it with solid ink, you know, pucks.
Oh, yeah.
And
crayons.
We could call them crayon jet. Then they complained they had to refill the crayons every 6 hours, so they couldn't let it run overnight.
Right.
Because, we just cut your lead
Hire
time.
Somebody.
We cut your lead time from a year to a month. And
right.
So, yeah, hire someone to come in early, and yeah, so last person to leave, fill them up. Next person to come in early, fill them up again.
Right. So yeah, no, I used to love those.
They didn't have to stick them together from two strips. It was one strip 54 inches wide.
I used to love those solid ink printers.
Yep.
They were sort of a waxy. They looked like giant crayons.
Crayons.
Yeah.
They were very cool.
And we had one customer somehow managed to fit the wrong color into the wrong bin.
They're different. They're just shapes.
But if you push hard enough.
Okay, I guess. Well, they're waxy, so you could shave off the edges.
Yeah.
Well, you're not using a big enough hammer if it doesn't fit. And I get it.
A square peg in a round hole.
And then you look at the pictures you used to see about a newspaper press.
Yeah.
Just screaming by. So
those were the days. And now, you know, this is how many years of the paperless office?
Yeah.
The same number of years as the Linux desktop, I believe.
1985, when Apple released the LaserWriter.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. The paperless office. Adobe PageMaker and
we
the LaserWriter.
We released the printer, so it's the paperless office.
Yeah.
What? Okay, thank you. Got it.
The irony is it actually generated more paper.
Yep.
Because it was so easy to correct something in your word processor and print another copy. It was a really big deal if you made a typo, literally a typo in a typewriter. Is it enough to need the retype, or you tried to use whiteout, but that didn't look professional?
Right.
So, yeah, is it a bad enough typo to retype, or can you work on it?
Well, and that led to some really interesting things. It used to be that if you had a 9-pin printer,
mm-hmm.
okay, a dot matrix printer, you were professional. Because you had a computer and a printer.
Yep.
Then you had the Selectric that connected to the computer. Now you were professional if you went back to looking like you had typed it.
Yeah.
Then you got a laser printer. Now you could do all kinds of different fonts and all kinds of everything. So now you look professional if you had a laser printer.
And people
now
everybody's use Courier.
And people used to use Courier. Now everybody's got a laser printer. It doesn't matter anymore. But there was a time when if it was typed, you were professional. Then if it was dot matrix, you were professional. Yep. Then if it was typed again, you were professional. Then if it was laser printed, you were professional.
I remember it was how I met my current boss. She worked at a computer store. And me and my buddy would go down to lust after the color laser printer. Oh. First color laser printer on the network, on the market, was only $50,000.
Yeah.
And they let us do test prints, so we did.
Yeah, of course.
And you know, everyone knew we weren't going to buy it, but they had one in the store, so a business could buy one if they had that need and could justify that expense. But only $50,000, and now a color laser printer is $150,000.
Yeah, I honestly don't know why people still buy inkjets.
They're cheaper initially, so that's why they buy them.
Buy one for $35. Yeah. I get that.
But
I do get that.
If you don't print enough, the ink dries out, clogs up the heads, ruins the printer.
Too many problems.
Yeah, liquid ink is still best for photographs.
Yes.
So if you print a lot of photographs, liquid ink is pretty good.
Yes.
But if you want to print snapshots, I have a really great Kodak 4x6 Dysub printer that prints perfect, you know, color snapshots.
And Dysub is beautiful.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
So what we're seeing now is inkjet printers that have larger tanks. The other big problem with it inkjet printers is the cost of the ink.
Right.
Typically, those little cartridges are half a milliliter
right.
for $20, and that works out to like $5,000 a gallon. So a lot of the companies are now making bigger tanks. So you pour ink into the tank, and they've done a real good job, especially the Epson IncoTank brand, to not spill the ink. Because we used to be able to refill your liquid ink, and you'd spill it everywhere and ruin everything. But now you can refill the ink. So the cost per print is down. The printer initial price is a little bit higher than the smaller tanks. But now it's still sort of the same thing. You have to print enough to justify the risk of clogging the heads because you have to keep printing again and again. So cleaning your printer heads is such a common thing to do. Eventually, it doesn't work if you let it sit for too long.
Right. And again, you have to print color stuff.
Yeah.
So if most of what you print is text, it's useless to buy a color printer.
Right.
And the other problem with inkjet printers is the ink runs. If you get it wet, it runs. So if you take it to a meeting, you get caught in the rain, you're kind of done.
I remember an HP that had a UV heater. You could see the purple light hitting the ink to dry the ink as it came out faster. And for the longest time, they couldn't do double-sided inkjet.
Right.
Because the ink would bleed when you put it back through.
Right.
And so now a lot of our customers, we recommend a black and white laser printer for all their regular day-to-day printing. And the occasion when you want to get a color photo, there's a lot of color photo online store, or you go down to your, like Target or Walmart or Wegmans. A lot of those will have photo kiosks, and you print your photos there. You need
Walgreens, all of those places. Yeah. So you consider when you're buying a printer what it is you really need to do, and how often you do those things. That'll help you figure out where you really need to be with a printer. I keep telling my wife I'll buy her a color laser printer for the stuff she prints for market. But she's perfectly happy with black and white. So, okay. All right.
Cheaper.
Yeah, and if it wasn't for her, I don't know that I would have a printer. The only thing I ever print is this stuff, the news every week. And that's just because I've got the printer already. It's more convenient.
Mm-hmm. You could read it on screen, but that's another window to toggle between.
right. But again, so this is more convenient, but it isn't necessary. I wouldn't even need a printer if I didn't do that. I can't think of the last time I printed anything else. Oh, wait, a test page. When I connected a new device, I would, Linux nowadays works like everything else. It automatically brings the printers up, goes and finds the printers on the network.
I printed a flyer for an air show coming up.
Yeah.
My printer is out of red.
I was about to say, is that the actual background color?
It's supposed to be red background, but it came out orange.
Yep. So. Yep. So, if you've got, and that's the deal with a color printer is, a lot of them are, used to be at least one tank.
Yeah. The liquid ink ones, especially the cheaper ones.
Right. All the colors are one in
cyan, magenta, yellow.
Right.
So, yellow is a pure color you often print.
Right.
You often don't print pure cyan, pure magenta. So every time you run out of yellow, you throw away the leftover cyan and magenta.
Right.
So then a printer company started marketing, we're a four-color printer or a six-color photo printer. Epson made a printer designed for black and white photographers. It had four different blacks. There was light gray, light gray, light gray.
Right.
And then it had a dye black and it had a pigment black.
The only time I had a color printer was when my daughter was young. And it was a four separate tanks in the little Canon printer because, thank God, because she went through a blue period.
Yeah.
Everything she printed was blue. Sometimes it's just a solid page of blue. Yeah. Okay. I didn't have to throw away the black and the yellow.
We had to happen in our office and after the third ink cartridge in a month. So we're getting a laser printer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, honey, go ahead and do what you got to do. I'll just buy the one or two cartridges that I need, and that's okay. But so, it depends on what you're doing and why you're doing it, and I was certainly happy to have a color printer for my daughter, but the minute she was done with it, it sat until it just crusted over and never printed again. That's just the way it is. Color inkjet printers will clog up, And once they do, getting them unclogged is not easy, if it happens at all, or cheap.
A lot of times you can replace the print head, but that costs more than a new printer.
Well, exactly. All right. That's it. That's it. That's it for this show. This show is in the books. I want to thank Dave Enright. I want to thank Steve Ray. I want to thank the Phantom.
Very well.
Who came in here with like smoke and will dissipate the same way. I'm Nick Francesco. I want to thank everybody who called in. Good show this week. I want to thank all of you who listen and all of you who vote in the poll. Please continue to do so. It's at soundbites.org. That's Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. If you're interested, you can join us tomorrow night at 9 p.m. in the Soundbites Lounge. Just go to our homepage at soundbites.org. You'll see it under interesting links. There's a link to the lounge. We meet from 9 to 10 by video chat. And other than that, we will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?